From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, just 6 days after a mass shooting, New Zealand is banning military-style weapons.
The time for the mass and easy availability of these weapons must end. And today, they will.
New Zealand's former Prime Minister joins us in studio to talk about the quick turnaround. Also, we're joined by Preet Bharara. He was U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York until President Trump fired him.
But people think that America will be healed if Bob Mueller recites chapter and verse a lot of misconduct on the part of the president, then they're mistaken. Because even if he does that, it goes to the Congress.
And why are progressive cities like Boston so expensive for young and low-income people?
Homeowners make a lot of money by limiting supply. I mean, the reason that homes are worth so much in all these cities is because they don't let anything get built.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. 6 days after a terrorist attack left 50 people dead, New Zealand is banning military-style guns. Here's New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern earlier today.
Every semi-automatic weapon used in the terrorist attack on Friday will be banned in this country.
The ban takes effect almost immediately. It covers high-capacity magazines and devices like bump stocks that make semi-automatic guns perform like machine guns. Now, Ardern is a member of New Zealand's center-left Labour Party, but the ban also has support from the center-right National Party. Jenny Shipley once led the National Party and was New Zealand's prime minister from 1997 to 1999. She's in town this week, mentoring women leaders for a women's leadership group called Vital Voices, and she's in our studio now. Prime Minister Shipley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
I know you graduated from Christ Church Teachers College in 1972 in the city where two mosques were attacked just last week. So how are you processing a tragedy that is so rare in your country and that must hit very close to home for you?
Well, I think to put it in the Prime Minister's context, she's made clear that New Zealanders are genuinely heartbroken that this could happen here, particularly where people were at prayer. I mean, we are an inclusive and shared society that's safe for difference, and this is a huge affront and genuinely held. I think the second thing that I share with her is her determination not to give this evil criminal notoriety. And she will not let this event move New Zealanders from a hopeful nation to a fearful nation. And so she's choosing her language extremely carefully, and I think this is a moment where that's very important, and it's trailblazing.
Now, we've heard her talk about saying, you will never hear me say his name. She does not want to give that.
That is true, but she's saying this is the victims, this is their time.
Yeah.
And many of these people, I mean, this was the most orchestrated evil act we've seen, set up to manipulate social media, live cameras, broadcast manifesto. We must not give these people air. And I think she, with her careful language and her determination not to give him oxygen, is actually sending an extremely strong message to the centre-right extremists. And then she's acted. Now, in New Zealand, we have a single-tier parliament. And I think that this is so meaningful and so devastating and so offensive to our way of life that it was a moment where we chose as a nation to act. The whole of the parliament, with the exception of one person, has said that they will agree to support this change.
And you would have supported it if you were still in office?
Oh, of course. Look, there are things aligning. We are in fiscal surplus as a nation. We've worked hard and in a position where we can buy back these weapons. So there's a convergence of opportunity. The Prime Minister has made it extremely clear that she will not accept any argument on everybody's behalf. And this is a moment we will act and move. She's got the money to do it. She's got the political collateral to do it. And she's going to set an agenda where the Parliament has said it will pass the legislation urgently. And the buyback will happen over a number of months.
I'm sure, though, you're familiar enough with the United States from your time as head of state in New Zealand to appreciate how different this experience is. I mean, really, it's hard to imagine for an American audience that you would have politicians on the left and right getting behind an assault weapons ban. And the speed is also remarkable. I mean, we're talking 6 days here. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was just tweeting today, reminding people that the Sandy Hook massacre happened 6 years ago, and we can't even get the Senate to hold a vote on universal background checks. She's talking, of course, yes, about the elementary school shooting that killed 26 children. I mean, the contrast is stark, isn't it?
Well, look, it is, and I don't want to pass judgment. I mean, each of our nations is different, but our police officers do not walk around with pistols on their hips. Our customs officers do not. We allow them to have them very closely available, but we claim the space to be safe. And we will not allow the use of arms to intimidate people around freedom, although we have a very capable police force and a comprehensive system to back it up. So these are choices, and New Zealand's made its choice.
Just to note on the Sandy Hook shooting, that was 26 children and educators altogether. Let me just fill in a couple more details, though, on the ban that was just passed. You know, there isn't even a grandfather clause, and that's a remarkable thing, too. There's going to be a gun buyback program that will cost an estimated $100 to $200 million. Eventually, somebody possessing a banned weapon could owe a $4,000 fine or spend 3 years in prison. This is really quite serious, and I will point out that even people who support an assault weapons ban in the United States typically caution existing gun owners, don't worry, we're not coming for your guns.
No. Look,
you know, so that's another huge contrast.
I think that you can't be halfway pregnant, if I can be so bold as a woman leader. If we're going to do this, we have to do it properly. And look, don't let's pretend. We live in an age where even if we allow people, we do this ban, online purchasing is very real. So this is a comprehensive strategy the Prime Minister's laid out. She will buy everything back. You can't forward buy. You can't bring them in. The customs won't allow it if you get caught having done so or not disclosing. So if you don't hand this in, then there will also, it's also a criminal act that if you're subsequently post a certain date found owning either a semi-automatic weapon or even handguns that can be modified into military type devices. I think they've been quite careful with the definition and I don't have the detail, but we're trying to stop this mass type risk. New Zealanders do use guns on their farms. You know, we shoot game and we shoot possums, but you do not need semi-automatic rifles to do that. And so we are discriminating with purpose here, that we're not going to have terror, but we are going to have the practical use of guns where they are required, legally available.
So there's the mechanism in this attack, right, the gun, but there's also the motive, right, which was white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me in coverage that much of your country was really taken off guard, did not see white supremacy as a big problem in the country, was surprised to see this happen. What was your response? Were you equally surprised, or do you think white supremacy is a growing problem in New Zealand?
I think this person is a criminal and a murderer, and he's an animal. And I'm not going to give him the language of white supremacy either. I understand there are a group of people who, for a range of reasons, can't accept that the world has changed. You know, I was born when there were 2.5 million people, a billion people on Earth. There's now 7.5. And I think there are some people who feel that their interests and values are crowded out. But nothing on Earth justifies the types of actions that we saw last week. And as the Prime Minister's leading us, saying, yes, there are people who think this, but this is not a New Zealander, by the way. It happened in New Zealand. But there is no evidence that there's a deeply held cell of people. This person clearly acted alone. I'm not seeking to say it doesn't happen or it doesn't matter, but we will arrest people if they are caught pushing this material around, because it is beyond our values and we view it as objectionable material. And there's a definition of objectionable material in New Zealand, and you can be prosecuted for pushing it.
We're speaking with Jenny Shipley, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand. And I know, Prime Minister, you said at the top that you were in town with a women's leadership group, Vital Voices. I know you're also a member of the Council of Women World Leaders. This is 75 current and former heads of state. You were the first female Prime Minister in the 1990s in your country. There have been two more since your time. None here in the United States, or no presidents, would be our equivalent, obviously. But to what do you attribute the difference? I mean, it's just that the parliamentary system is different, or something else?
I think that there's been a journey that New Zealand's been on. Interestingly, with our Maori people, So in the 70s, 80s, 90s, we realized that unless there was a valuing and respecting of difference for our Indigenous people, and then some proper reparation around atrocities and unfairness, that we couldn't move ahead with confidence. So there's been a long, systematic piece of attention paid to inclusion and meaningful actions around how people feel included. But remember, this is a country that we were the first to give women the vote. New Zealand in 1893 gave women the vote. And so there's a culture of women and men getting on and doing things together. I think it's still very difficult. I'm not pretending. There were glass ceilings I had to break. Helen Clark, who followed me again, was still demanding. But interestingly now, my granddaughter has three women role models. You know, my children were older when I was Prime Minister. Helen and Peter chose not to have children. Jacinda's got a baby. How lucky are we that our sons and our daughters are growing up seeing normalised women's leadership, where you can be compassionate, decisive. I mean, I've deployed troops to war. Jacinda's dealt with this type of crisis. I think we have got past the opportunistic now to an embedded, this is who we are. This is quite normal. We all bring different political lenses to this. And I'm thrilled to be here in Boston sharing that with what I hope will be future leaders of their respective countries.
And you mentioned a word a moment ago that's really on topic in American politics right now, and that was reparations. You talked about it in the context of your Indigenous people in New Zealand. This is on the minds of American voters right now. Our Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's running for president, has talked about reparations for African Americans, who, of course, were enslaved and has a long history of segregation in this country. So what was your experience with reparations? Is that something that you think could work here?
Well, what we realized was that we had a treaty in 1840, and it laid out how we would work together at the moment where colonization had got traction. And then we let them down. Maori lost their land, and that deprivation led to a great deal of disadvantage. In the mid-80s, we realized that actually we can't give them that land back, but we would go through a process of acknowledging that loss. And there were deep studies and then apologies and so on. This built to a compensation process. And I'm very proud to say that some of the tribes that settled their treaty claims 20 or 25 years ago are now multi-billion dollar corporations. They're investing in their young people, they're purchasing land back themselves, they're full participants in society. I think the second thing we did in 1984 was reinstate the language, but we didn't teach it in universities. We established language nests, kindergartens, and the old women and old men came and taught children who were 2 and 3 and 4. I tell you what, those kids are now graduates in their mid to late 30s, early 40s. They know who they are. They shine with confidence. They're qualified now in universities, and they are building capacity, not only with their Maori people, but right across the economy. So from a huge and historically grievous inequality, there's been a series of steps of investment and acknowledgement. We're not there yet, but we're one of the more interesting countries where inclusion and valuing diversity so that we're a genuinely shared society that's safe for difference, not the same, but safe to be different and say, you know, I'm gay or I'm black or I'm Maori or I'm a woman or this is my preference. The culture there, while we still have some bias and some discriminating voices, the vast majority of New Zealanders are proud that this is who we are and this is the space we're in.
That's former New Zealand Prime Minister Jenny Shipley. Prime Minister, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, joins us. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're going to spend some time now with Preet Bharara. He served as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York for 7.5 years until 2017, when President Trump fired him shortly after taking office. Bharara had expected to stay on. Here he is in November 2016 in the lobby of Trump Tower talking about a meeting he just had with then-President-elect Trump.
We had a good meeting. I said I would absolutely consider staying on. I agreed to stay on. I have already spoken to Senator Sessions, who is, as you know, the nominee to be the Attorney General. He also asked that I stay on, and so I expect that I'll be continuing the work at the Southern District of New York.
Barrara is out with a new book called Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, but he joins us here first. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you open the book describing how you were writing it in the midst of what we'll call an involuntary career change. I think that's a nice way to put it.
Right.
And in your telling, the president called you in March of 2017. So this is just less than 3 months after he's taken office. And you didn't take the call. Why not? And do you regret that?
I don't regret it in the least. And in fact, it was less than 2 months after he took office. I didn't expect to be in the position of U.S. attorney after Donald Trump won the presidency. There's the natural tradition of the U.S. attorneys from the prior administration leaving in an orderly fashion so that there's continuity in the various offices that try to do justice in America. But he asked me to stay, and of his own accord. I met with him in Trump Tower. The clip you played was me coming down from the meeting, and Donald Trump shook my hand and said, yeah, I want you to stay. It's his prerogative to change his mind anytime he wants. It's his authority, and I don't have any dispute with that. The odd thing was, he began to call me, personally, not going through the Justice Department or any other transition officials when he was the president-elect, which is a little odd. You know, normally, sitting U.S. attorneys do not have a personal relationship and don't start to develop a personal relationship with someone who's going to take over the White House. But he was not yet the president, and I told folks about it, and we thought it was okay to take those calls. Then he became the president and called me on, I think, March 9th of 2017, and left a message because I had been away from my desk and my assistant had left early. And then that was an unusual circumstance, that you have a president who has, you know, various interests in the jurisdiction of the Southern District of New York, as people now very clearly know, given what my old office is doing with respect to Michael Cohen. And it's a real question of whether or not you subject yourself to an unmonitored conversation that bypasses all the protocols and doesn't have the attorney general on, not knowing what the nature of the conversation was going to be. And, you know, I didn't necessarily think he was going to ask me to do something untoward, but it seemed weird and odd to have a side conversation in that fashion, especially after Donald Trump himself had made such a big deal of the fact that then Attorney General Loretta Lynch met with Bill Clinton during the time that
right.
his wife, Hillary Clinton, was being investigated. And Donald Trump himself went to rally after rally saying, well, what do you think happened in that conversation? And I didn't want to put myself in a position that would be compromised and also, quite frankly, for the protection of the president himself. So 22 hours later, I was asked to resign. I can't prove that those two acts were related to each other, but I'd find it hard to believe that they weren't. And now, given what I know and the world knows about what Donald Trump thinks about the wall between politics and law enforcement, on the one hand, telling Jim Comey, can you lay off Michael Flynn if you believe Jim Comey? And I do. On the other hand, saying, can you do something with the Justice Department for Joe Arpaio? That he has a penchant for trying to interfere in law enforcement, particularly when it might suit his interests. And so I don't have any regrets at all about not calling the president back.
So you were thinking about proprietary optics and ultimately the rule of law. Do you believe that the current administration with the Justice Department now under William Barr shares those types of proprietary concerns?
I think most of them probably do. I think the line prosecutors in the 93 U.S. attorney's offices around the country, I think the people in my old office, I think they're great, upstanding men and women in the FBI, at Maine Justice. I think Bill Barr is a professional. I think he has a tough task in dealing with a mercurial president who hates the fact that anybody dares to investigate anything that comes into contact with him, whether it's his business or his foundation or people who he's employed. And he, you know, with a broad brush, paints everything as a witch hunt in the same way that he paints everything he doesn't like in the media as fake news. So I think there are a lot of people who are doing things the right way, but I think there's a lot of pressure from the White House to do otherwise.
Right. He's used that term witch hunt to describe the investigation being led by Robert Mueller, and we don't know when that's going to come, but it could come any day from what we understand. And the president did say just yesterday that he actually thinks the report should be made public.
Let it come out. Let people see it. That's up to the attorney general. We have a very good attorney general. He's a very highly respected man, and we'll see what happens. But it's sort of interesting that a man out of the blue just writes a report.
Just out of the blue.
Just out of the blue.
some former FBI director.
Right.
But in all seriousness, he is trying to use that kind of terminology, I think, to degrade public confidence in not only Mueller, but we've also seen him do it with sort of law enforcement in general. So what's your concern level about that?
He does it with everything and everyone that he doesn't agree with. He can't even be consistent on about Fox News, that is, you know, a lot of people think is basically state television. There are one or two anchors there who every once in a while deign to say something negative about Donald Trump, and he singles them out and says, well, they don't belong there. You know, one of the things I write about in the book is that if you're a prosecutor or an investigator, it is part of the job to take criticism from the people that you're investigating. Witch hunt is not a new epithet, a new description of things going on. And I describe how, you know, I was criticized. My office has been criticized sometimes for being too tough in the view of some people, sometimes for being too soft. But it's par for the course. You learn to take it. The difference is that when the potential subject or target is not some, you know, regular-sized billionaire or politician or state official, but the president of the United States, he has the biggest microphone on the planet. And when he decides to use his office and his pulpit to denigrate falsely in many ways someone who served his country honorably like Bob Mueller, that has a very, very insidious effect on the system. It has an insidious effect on people's faith in the system, and I think it's something we should be worried about.
So the Mueller report is probably the one that we're all waiting with the greatest bated breath for. Yeah. But as you mentioned earlier, your former office is also conducting its own investigatory work, largely around Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney. And that partly centers on president's payments to women who alleged to have had affairs with him more than a decade ago, Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. And we've heard others, including Alan Dershowitz, say that it's actually investigations in the Southern District of New York that should most alarm the president, even more so than the Mueller report. Do you agree?
I do, based on what I know from publicly available information. That's for a few reasons. One, they are not limited in scope as to what they can look at. Unlike the Mueller team, the special counsel's office is very circumscribed in what they're allowed to look at based on the mandate under which he was appointed. Second, I think the nature of the folks at the Southern District who are apolitical, who follow the law and the facts wherever they lead. I tell a lot of stories in the book about, you know, the culture and the philosophy and the DNA and the character of the people in the Southern District. And so if people are wondering what that place is like, you'll learn a lot about it in the pages of the book, which I dedicate to my family first and then second to the men and women of the Southern District of New York. They also have an independent streak. And I mean in an appropriate way, that they are not swayed by public opinion in one direction or the other. They're not afraid of people who are in power. And so I think they'll do what's right. And they're very smart, hardworking, and dedicated to the rule of law.
Well, that was certainly the takeaway I got from your book. And I wonder if you could just explain that a little bit more, because you're raising some acute concerns now. But I read your book and came away with the sense that you have an overall optimistic take on our justice system, even as you point out some flaws. So why do you remain optimistic?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's lots of different things that need fixing in the justice system. I think criminal justice reform can go a lot further than it has gone. And I think that there are a lot of people sort of at the line level, you know, the everyday folks who you don't see on television and whose names you may not know, many of whom have great stories that I tell in the book. I think they're in a great place. But you know what? Leadership matters, too. And what the president says about the leadership matters also. And you have this drumbeat every day from the president denigrating not just particular people in the FBI who are gone, but in large measure, the FBI generally, the intelligence community generally, and taking the word of strong men like Vladimir Putin and others over the word of his own intelligence community, law enforcement community, I think that has, you know, I think that has a very detrimental effect on those agencies, and also on people's perception of those agencies. You know, every day, FBI agents and law enforcement officials go into court and they raise their right hand and they testify about the facts of a case. And you have a president who's undermining their credibility generally. I understand that people might say, well, he's singling people out. He doesn't really do that in the same way that he conflates legal immigration and illegal immigration. When push comes to shove, his supporters will say, well, no, he's talking about a couple of bad apples or he's talking about illegal immigration. But if you follow the rhetoric overall and the dog whistles that are issued, he's painting a broad brush over and over and over again, and that's not good for the justice system.
So you write about a long career in which you take on the likes of Al-Qaeda, the mafia, Wall Street. But as you well know, some Americans do question whether you were tough enough on that last group, on Wall Street, after the financial crisis of the last decade, and they wonder why so few bankers were convicted of crimes. So what do you say to those people?
Yeah, I say they're right to be frustrated, and I spend time in the book talking about one of the most difficult things a prosecutor has to learn to do is to walk away when you believe that there has been misconduct and people have been hurt. If the law doesn't allow you to bring the case, if the standard is such that you can't meet it, and the facts aren't there, you don't have a cooperating witness or you don't have a wiretap, then the just thing to do, even if it's frustrating, in our system, is you don't bring the criminal case. Maybe there are other punishments. Maybe there can be a civil case, although I will note that there was no even regulatory matter by any agency against the head of a financial institution in the wake of the financial crisis, even though regulatory agencies have a much lower burden of proof. And the people who got assigned cases that might have led to some prosecution at the highest level in connection with the financial crisis, and there are many offices, not just mine, in D.C., in California, in New Jersey, in Chicago, in many other places. And out of hundreds and hundreds of career folks, I'm not aware of anyone suggesting or recommending to a U.S. attorney or to the attorney general that there was a makeable case. And that is extraordinarily frustrating because there was a lot of harm. But a lot of people worked really hard and put in a lot of resources, but did not find a case to make. And I get that. But, you know, sometimes the case can't be made. Sometimes people engaged in conduct that allowed them, you know, the ability to avoid prosecution. And sometimes the conduct was reckless, greedy, venal, negligent, but didn't cause someone to say there was a provable crime.
I do want to ask you about one other point of criticism that you address in the book. You describe the, quote, avalanche of vitriol and bile that came with your prosecution of an Indian diplomat in 2013. I'm sure you remember this episode very well.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping you can remind us a little bit more. Would you read a little bit of what you wrote about that episode on page 207 of your book?
You got very far in the book. I appreciate that. This is when we prosecuted an Indian diplomat, not for a crime of the century, but for visa fraud and failing to pay a domestic worker, I think, more than $1 a day. So as I write on page 207, talk show hosts in India took to calling me a self-loathing Indian who made it a point to go after people from the country of his birth. My colleagues and I found it all a bit odd because the alleged victim in the case was also Indian. An Indian official asked on television, "Who the hell is Preet Bharara?" I was identified on another program as the most hated man in that country. The criticism grew more and more intense, which might not have bothered me so much had my parents not been reading every word of it. It upset them greatly. Then came the evening when my daughter overheard a conversation in the living room. She asked me, "Daddy, what is an Uncle Tom?" Because that's what I was being called by journalists in South Asia. That was not pleasant. It certainly wasn't.
So how on earth did you answer the question? What'd you tell her?
You know, I explained to her the origin of it. I don't remember the exact words I used, but, you know, people who are listening know what that means. And part of the point I make in the book is, look, everyone is subject to criticism. And to grow as a person, you need to be able to distinguish between criticism that's meritorious and take that as feedback and improve yourself, but then criticism that's ludicrous and stupid, like that was. And those allegations were, you have to take a little bit with a grain of salt. I go on, I won't read the whole thing, but I go on to say that the moment when I really thought it was getting overly ludicrous and my attitude changed a little bit and I got a better sense of perspective on it was at some point somebody in the Indian press said that, you know, they knew that I was, my office was prosecuting these people and this diplomat for the following reason, that I'd undertaken the case for only one reason, to serve my quote-unquote white masters. My white masters, presumably Eric Holder and Barack Obama. So you realize
the irony
of that, yes.
A former president there, Eric Holder, a gentleman who's mulled a run for president. Last question to you, Preet Bharara. Are you thinking about higher office yourself?
Well, I was born in India, so no presidency for
no
me.
Presidency,
I'm not going to be one of the 3,500 people who are running. You know, I like public service. I enjoyed my time in public service. I did it for 17 years. If there's another way I can serve, I would look forward to it. Politics is not my cup of tea, so I don't see that happening anytime soon.
All right. Preet Bharara served as the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York from 2009 to 2017. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, and there's more information about that event at radioboston.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4247. 617-917.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Boston, San Francisco, New York, these are some of the most progressive and reliably democratic cities in the country. Yet they're also the places that are increasingly pricing out minority, immigrant, young, low-income, and middle-class residents from some neighborhoods. City data shows that a retail salesperson making a typical salary in Boston, for example, now has to pay more than 60% of his or her income to afford an average two-bedroom rental. Author Randy Shaw explores this discrepancy in his new book, Generation Priced Out: Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? He's the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco and a longtime housing and homelessness activist, and he joins me now in studio. Randy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And for a more local perspective on this conversation, we're joined by Greg Vassell. He's the president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Greg, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Have you been priced out of your own neighborhood? How should Boston area preserve and create affordable housing? Real estate taxes? Rent control? Maybe you're a developer worried about the high cost of building around Boston. Well, if you are, you can give us a ring. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Randy Shaw, let me begin with you and your book. You've been working, I know, on housing policy for a long time. So what inspired you to write this book now?
Well, I was originally inspired by the Ghost Ship Fire, which occurred on December 2nd, 2016 in Oakland, which killed 36 people. And a light went off on me and said, well, you know, Oakland used to be the affordable alternative to San Francisco, but now even Oakland wasn't affordable. And I started to look at all these blue cities, progressive cities that claim to support inclusion and racial diversity, yet their land use policies are working against those goals. And, you know, it's gotten so bad. You mentioned about teachers where there's teacher strikes all over the country.
Sure.
Because teachers, it's not that simply that teachers can't afford to live in specific neighborhoods in all these cities I write about. They can't afford to live in the cities they teach anywhere. And it's a big problem. And our cities have to change. We have to build more housing. We have to get rid of exclusionary zoning and protect tenants better. But mainly, we have failed for decades to build enough housing in almost every major city in the country.
And you write about that Ghost Ship Fire as an example of people getting priced out of legitimate housing. They had resorted to illegal housing in that case. So
right.
Who do you blame primarily for that phenomenon?
Well, I blame there's a number of factors. For the low-income side, it's obviously the federal government not funding people, and 75% of the families entitled to federal housing assistance don't get it. But for the people who earn more than that, working people, it's really local land use policies where you have vast stretches of Oakland and San Francisco and Berkeley and Boston and every city I named, Austin and Minneapolis until they just changed it, where you are not allowed to build an apartment building. And this will surprise your listeners because they have an image of San Francisco as being a very tenant town. Over half of San Francisco, you can build a mansion, but not an apartment building. You can't build a triplex, but you can build a mansion. Why is our zoning set up to facilitate mansions for rich, rich, rich people and not more affordable housing for the millennials who desperately need it? And that's what I write about in Generation Priced Out.
And Greg Vassell, how do you see the state of housing here in Greater Boston? I mean, do you see some of the problems that Randy is raising, or is this just the free market? I mean, you know, we do live in a capitalist country. You build and you make a profit. That's what developers do, right?
Yeah, Randy and I actually agree on this, and we've struggled with this in Boston. When the new Walsh administration came in, the whole thought was we want to build denser, we want to build higher, and a lot of people were alarmed by that. Many people in Boston like the look and feel of the neighborhood. But they're not really crazy about going higher and denser. A couple weeks ago, there was a story in the Boston Globe about an area in Reedville that was some transit-oriented development. It lent itself perfectly for some dense housing development. Local community, NIMBY activists, we don't want this in our community. And that's a problem. If we're going to be a world-class city, we've got to embrace things like that and build on property and land like that.
Right. Those Reedville residents kind of felt like they had been shielded from the development for a while, and now all of a sudden developers were discovering them, and they weren't thrilled about it. If you live in Reedville or somewhere else in Boston, please feel free to give us a ring. You can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Brianne is calling from Concord. Hi there, Brianne. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Yep, I live in Concord. I've been here 15 years. I'm a renter. I've wanted to buy, but I'm priced out of the market. Now I'm trying to find other rentals to get out of a situation that I'm in, and it's impossible. Studios here start at around $1,800 a month, little tiny spaces, and one bedroom's around 2,000, and, you know, how much farther out do you have to go to find anything affordable? Or even going further in, closer into Boston where I used to live, everything's just gotten to be, I think it's out of control.
Well, I would say when you artificially restrict supply, as all these cities do, and they don't let you build enough rental housing, the price is going to go up. And the terrible thing is if you were to live in Concord or have to go further away and drive an hour to your job, what about climate change? And we have people driving an hour and a half as a standard course to get because they have to get the affordable housing, and it's really the major course of major cause of greenhouse gas emissions. So I sympathize very much with your caller.
Brianne, thank you so much for the call. And I'll just point out, as she says, she's paying about $1,800 a month for a studio. That is roughly the state median for at least a one-bedroom, according to the real estate website Zumper. And other places, of course, are much more expensive. In Boston, for example, the median for a one-bedroom right now is $2,390 a month. It's the same in Brookline. Quincy, a little bit cheaper, a little under $2,000 a month. But Greg Vassily, I'm sure you're familiar with these figures. You know this market well. How much does Brianne's story resonate, and do you have any guidance for her?
It absolutely resonates with me. And we fight this fight all the time up on Beacon Hill. Many communities don't have appropriate zoning for multifamily development. And we see this not exclusively, but to a great deal in the suburbs especially. You can't expect cities like Boston to carry the entire load for housing production. You need the local communities. And that's one of the reasons why when the governor filed his housing bill 2 years ago, he brought in the mayors from the local communities surrounding the city, because it has to be a regional effort. It can't be looked at as one community solving everybody's problems.
You know, especially, and as you well know, Massachusetts has a state law which requires a two-thirds vote for housing approvals. Now, why? Why are we trying to discourage housing to such an extent? So even cities that have a majority vote for a project, that's not sufficient.
And that's the exact law we're trying to get rid of in some of the legislation that's up on Beacon Hill right now.
We're talking with Randy Shaw. He's the director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco and author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America, and also with Greg Vassil, who is the president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne is in Jamaica Plain. Hi there, Anne.
Hi. I was calling to ask what's being done by our elected officials to oversee and kind of control developers. Like, there's one called City Realty Group that I was notified of. I live in Jamaica Plain. I'm a community health nurse. I'm a long-term resident. I have two kids I'm raising in the city. And I see so many neighbors getting pushed out, priced out because of new sort of high-end loft luxury condo buildings. And City Realty, I guess I got a action alert, is sort of forcing out some local small businesses and other neighbors that make our community the kind of place why so many people want to live here, diverse, vibrant, and they tout being like local community members from Boston, and they have a nonprofit arm that supports kids in the city. But when I looked into it, it just seemed too good to be true. I looked them up, and this group, City Kids, their nonprofit, is actually run out of Brookline, Mass, and doesn't really seem to be doing everything they say it's doing. So I just want someone in city government to be sort of a watchdog on this, as my neighbors are getting priced out, and it's really changing the fabric of our neighborhood in a not a positive way. So I don't know if the author has any suggestions or insight into this kind of dynamic.
Well, a nonprofit should not be doing that. If that were a for-profit entity in Massachusetts, and, you know, in any city, you don't have any right to rent control or just cause eviction. So anytime a landlord, if someone wants to come in and just raise the rent and turn over your building, you can't stop it. And I think that's something that all the cities that have banned rent controls have to, at the state level, have to relook at, because the ability just to tell a long-term resident like your caller that, hey, you can just have to leave because we just don't want you here anymore, that's not fair. In California, we have just – in San Francisco, Los Angeles, we have just cause eviction, and landlords are doing quite well with it. So I think it's definitely consistent, but that's the kind of thing that happens in Massachusetts.
And I know, you know, Randy, you have a lot of case studies in your book, one of which is right in our backyard in Cambridge, and particularly in Central Square. What did you find going on there that caught your attention?
Well, Cambridge is really one of the most interesting interesting housing environments in the country because you have, you know, sort of a progressive split over development and where things are going. And there's a big fight right now over an affordable housing overlay, which they just had a huge turnout last night at a hearing. And so hopefully it'll have a happy ending. But, you know, the question of people, as Greg said, who just don't want anything built and feel like Cambridge and other cities are big enough versus people who say, hey, we can expand affordability by increasing density.
I want to bring in another voice to the conversation. Nancy Ryan is president of the Cambridge Residents Alliance. She's very familiar with what's going on in that city and in Central Square, and she joins us now on the line. Nancy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. The author may not be aware that we actually worked to do some upzoning in Central Square just in the last year and a half, but we upzoned to a reasonable level of, you know, five, six stories up over two or three stories. But the project that the author lists in his book was Mass and Main. It's a huge development of 308 units that was going to be and now is almost completed. It's three times what the height zoning was allowing, making a huge wall in front of the poorest neighborhood in Cambridge. And it's got 90 studios. The two beds go for $3,758, and the three beds go for $4,400. So I don't know the families that are going to be able to afford that. And the 20% inclusionary units for low-income people that we have fought for, that 20% is going to come out of some of these 90 studios. So we really haven't ended up with a project that is really going to serve the needs of the community for low and moderate family housing. So was the project that was referenced in the book, and I was a little disappointed that no one ever spoke to us before they understood why we might oppose it.
Well, unless Cambridge has completely done its inclusionary housing law, every inclusionary housing law I'm aware of, the inclusionary affordable units have to match the unit type. So they couldn't – there has to be two-bedroom units as that inclusionary, unless Cambridge has done an inclusionary law that I've never heard of because
– Oh, no. That's the inclusionary law. That's the complaint that you got 90 studios. And so a huge percentage of the inclusionary units for lower-income people are going to be studios.
Well, it has to mirror the market rate. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah.
Nancy.
So there will be two-bedroom affordable ones because two-bedroom market rate are being built.
Nancy, though,
a few. We actually we had to lobby for 10 affordable three-bedrooms in order to allow them to have any number of studios that they wanted. And so they're building out a third of their project as studios.
Nancy, I wanted to ask you while we have you, just what your sort of more intangible concerns might be about overdevelopment in Cambridge, because it is a city with a lot of historic housing, very pretty buildings and whatnot, and there is a certain character to it that I understand your group wants to preserve as well. Tell me about that.
Well, our group doesn't talk about the character of the neighborhoods. What we talk about is the safety and security of the neighborhoods. And so, for instance, some of the larger development that's going on in Cambridge is going on in floodplains. That will endanger the housing that's getting built there as well as the adjacent neighborhoods because they will be not protected through the floodplain. So the developers are building luxury units in very dangerous places, and we're concerned about that. We are concerned about things like our tree canopy and all, but we think there are very healthy trade-offs between larger buildings than we have now in some of the neighborhoods where the houses are smaller and the yards are larger. We think that we haven't been given a really good look at what are the trade-offs and where can we make them. Instead, we're being told buy this one-size-fits-all 100% affordable overlay versus what are some real meaningful trade-offs. And we're thinking that the public discussion that really was large and wonderful last night is going to continue while we refine this and we come to some understanding of how we can really add meaningful, affordable housing in the city.
All right. Nancy Ryan from the Cambridge Residents Alliance, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We're talking about housing in Greater Boston and beyond with Randy Shaw, author of Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America, and Greg Vassell, president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. And Greg, I want to come back to you now. The concerns that Nancy is describing in Cambridge, I mean, how commonplace is that? Is that sort of isolated to that one city, or is she speaking for a much broader region?
Well, I mean, some of the comments that she just made are interesting, and they're echoed other places. housing is a crisis. I think everybody agrees to that. But then we're also worried about losing land to climate change, which is a concern. But we would rely on our government entities not to direct us to allow us to build in areas that are going to be turned into Venice in the not too distant future. So it is, but it's frustrating because if housing is really a priority, we should throw everything we have at trying to produce housing. The other stuff we'll figure it out, but housing should be paramount because it really helps our economy. If people don't have places to live, the companies won't come here.
Let's see if we can squeeze in a few more calls before the hour is out. Steve is giving us a ring from Alston. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I work with a lot of international students who come to Boston for the high-quality universities. And I don't know if your guests are familiar with this. There are several buildings around the Downtown Crossing neighborhood, Science Park, West End, that are essentially dormitories. And these developers build these really big high-rise apartments that are extremely expensive. I'm talking $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month. And families from overseas, very, very wealthy families, have an essentially unlimited pool of money to send their kids to school in Boston and put them up in these posh apartments. And if I'm a developer and I know that that's one spigot of money that I can count on being essentially unlimited, then I have no motive to build affordable housing because I can have these high-margin housing units that I build, and I know that the students are going to show up. So I'm wondering if there's something that can be done about that, not to chase students away, but just to make sure that everybody has an equal cut of the pie.
Well, one thing you do in San Francisco, and I'm friends with a developer named Patrick Kennedy, who contracts with schools to build the housing, and they agree on the rate beforehand. So that's what schools should do. And increasingly in San Francisco, they are.
Steve, thanks for the ring. Joseph is calling from Fitchburg. Joseph, what's going on up in Fitchburg? You're pretty far out of the city. I would think that it would be cheap housing up there, no? What are you finding?
It's a little of both, but there's a lot of disingenuousness around this issue from so many sides, and I'm curious what the author thinks about the fact that it's not the 1% that are behind this, it's the 20%. They will go to great lengths to protect their little enclaves. And the developers have literally no reason to build affordable housing anywhere in any urban center in the United States. There's too much money out there in this country and other countries, as your last caller just brought forth. And I'm curious what he thinks about what can be done, because we constantly talk about housing as if it were an isolated issue or that rent control is the answer, which I think New York has conclusively demonstrated not so much. But we need to get together as a community, but people need to give up their little bailiwick and realize they don't own this little fiefdom of who lives next door.
Well, Joseph, you've just hit the exact one of the major themes of Generation Priced Out, which is homeowners deciding that no apartment should be built in their neighborhood inflates the cost overall. The reason you keep hearing about Wall Street developers is because that's the only place you can build in the downtown areas. The neighbors have, because of homeowner pressure, and of course, homeowners are making out like bandits. The best job you can have in San Francisco is to be a single-family home. You make $60,000 a year, and you don't have to go to work in equity. It's a great deal.
You can work from home.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Joseph, thanks for the ring. I do want to, Joseph mentioned possible solutions, and I do want to raise one other. Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards has an idea for how we might address this housing crisis in Boston. She is proposing a tax of up to 6% on all real estate transactions over $2 million and up to 25% tax on properties sold more than once in a two-year period, basically like a flipping tax. So here she is describing her proposal for higher fees.
How could we not try to capture as much income right now in one of the best economies, the time where we're building the most in Boston? How could we not try to capture some of that income to direct it 100% towards affordable housing?
So Greg Vassell, president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, how about that? Does that proposal sound like a good one to you?
We do not support the transfer tax. And one of the reasons why is it captures such a small amount of the transactions. I think that as an industry, we would look very carefully at something that was more broadly across the board that affected everyone. For example, like the CPA in Boston that was put in, which is a surcharge on real estate taxes that everybody pays. So I think that would be something that the industry would take a long, hard look at if it was more evenly portioned out.
Well, this is where Greg and I disagree. I think that you get a lot of credit to that councilman for putting that forward. And I would have the opposite view. Because it only affects 500 transactions, that's a perfect thing to tax. You're taxing only the really super rich, and that's a great thing for Boston. Unfortunately, it has to win at the state level, which could be challenging. But good for Boston for trying.
The one thing that was disconcerting was at the hearing, the city's assessing department was very concerned that it was going to drive down the cost of buildings and it was going to result in lower property taxes realized for the city. So that's a concern.
We're just about out of time for today, so thank you so much to all of our callers for your participation today. We know the board is lit up, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you, but you can comment at RadioBoston.org or feel free to tweet us at RadioBoston. Randy Shaw's new book is called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America? He'll be at Porter Square Books tonight, and there's more information at our website, RadioBoston.org. Randy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And we were also joined by Greg Vassell, president of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Greg, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And Nancy Ryan joined us as well from the Cambridge Residents Alliance. Our thanks to her as well. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.